Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, same wall, your favorite professor, here to get you back on the straight and narrow. Today I'm going to talk about something called the pizza effect. But, of course, it's not about the effect that pizza has on our collective waistlines or the Buzzkill bulge. The pizza effect is something that affects our thinking about the history and origins of foods, of traditions, of and different practices of different cultures. It's about what qualifies as culturally authentic and about how some of the history of different cultures has affected our perceptions of cultural attributes. For instance, ask anybody where pizza was invented and they will almost invariably reply Italy. And most people will probably tell you, if pressed, that it's a traditional Italian dish from, you know, centuries ago. Ask anybody where yoga comes from, and the reply will be, with certainty, India. And most people will probably tell you, if they know a little bit about yoga, that it's an ancient practice developed over centuries by Hindu mystics. Those who have been told a little bit more about Indian Hindu mysticism, or may have practiced it themselves, will further tell you that it's based on the Bhagavad Gita, the most revered text in Hindu culture. It's their Bible. But ask any good buzzkiller about these things, and they'll tell you about the complications in the history of pizza and the history of yoga. They'll tell you about assumptions about ancient cultural practices, about myths of unchanging development, and about cultural appropriation. They may even drop in academic terms such as hermeneutical feedback loop and re-enculturation. And if they're feeling hip and with it, and after you've given them your baffled and exhausted look, they'll tell you it's all part of the pizza effect. And again, that's what today's episode is about. The pizza effect helps explain why assumptions about the history and development of certain cultural practices and traditions are among the strongest historical myths out there. It explains how they're self-reinforcing and how they can build up mistaken images and misunderstandings about cultural identity. Why are we talking about the pizza effect on the Professor Buzzkill show? Well, because so many of the historical myths and misconceptions we address here at the Buzzkill Institute come from the belief that ideas and practices have one historic cultural origin. And when we encounter something in our own countries as Indian or Italian, for instance, we all too often assume that it has existed in India or Italy in that form for centuries, and that it's still popular there today. And since we seem to want to base so much of our history on national identity, in fact, most historians, even these days, still refer to themselves as experts in national history, American history, Canadian history, Mexican history, although that seems to be changing somewhat in the last 10 years or so, maybe 20 years. Many of us assume that geography and national identity are the basis for other themes and approaches to history. You start off by being an American historian, a Canadian historian, a French historian, and then you move on to other things, economic history, things like that. The pizza effect was coined by anthropology professor Agahenanda Bharati at Syracuse University in 1970. He used the term to explain why some aspects of Indian culture and philosophy enjoyed a mid-20th century renaissance in India after having become popular in the West, right, particularly in Britain and North America. He used the term pizza effect, and we'll explain it a little bit later, because it's easier to conceptualize the pizza flow, if you will, across the Atlantic than the whole complicated flow of yoga and Indian philosophy halfway around the world. Essentially, what happened was this. Certain aspects of Indian culture and religion were studied heavily by European elites during the British Empire's control of South Asia in the 19th century. And some of these things, including the taste for Indian food that your average British soldier might have brought back, took root in Britain as early as the 1820s. As the 19th century progressed, British palates, especially London palates, were continually treated to South Asian cuisine. And yoga, as a spiritual as well as physical practice, came to Europe and North America in a similar way. Indian mystics and philosophers, rather than British soldiers and British civil servants, toured Europe and North America in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and they had a major influence on some of the new European spiritual movements and thinkers in the West. Much of yogic thought and practice was brought into these religions and philosophies because of this work. Now, the second thing that happened was that over the decades, these various things, yoga, philosophy, food, have changed both in South Asia and in the West. They've developed. They've been influenced by different styles and other ways of thinking, but somewhat surprisingly, without a great deal of further cross-cultural influence, if you see what I mean. And so when they did cross over again in the globe-trotting late 20th and early 21st centuries, examples of yoga practice, of Indian philosophy, and Indian cuisine were often quite different from each other. In fact, many popular Indian dishes had been invented in England and were unknown in South Asia, at least until recently. And in fact, it's the introduction of Western emphasis on certain Hindu texts in philosophy back to South Asia that led to the, quote, Hindu Renaissance in India that Professor Bharti discussed. That Hindu Renaissance was brought about, he said, by something he called the pizza effect. And we'll get into the details of that effect after this break. Okay, we're back. When he coined the phrase the pizza effect, Professor Bharti was referring to the idea, common in academic sociology and anthropology in the 60s and 70s, that pizza, as we have known and loved it, was kind of invented by Italian Americans and was exported back to Italy after World War II. Now, although there's something to the idea of pizza being an Italian-American rather than an Italian invention, it's not quite correct, historically speaking. It's more accurate to say that pizza is a Neapolitan invention coming from the area around Naples, which was then further developed and stylized by Neapolitan immigrants to the United States, and then became Italian. That is, it was introduced to the rest of Italy in the decades after World War II. That's why the pizza effect is sometimes referred to as the working of a cultural feedback loop. You see what I mean? The origins of pizza as a cuisine are relatively straightforward. It's not that difficult to imagine that for centuries, people have wanted to liven up bread and flatbreads with seasonings and sauces that would make it more interesting, yet still manageable enough to eat by hand, still a snack, if you will. In late 19th century Naples, bakeries and cafes started to experiment with different ways to make their flatbreads more appetizing. Now, it's not certain when tomatoes and tomato sauce were added to flatbreads, but it's very clear that open-air pizza cafes and pizza stands were operating in the early 1800s and throughout the 19th century. But there's absolutely no evidence that pizza was all the rage. In fact, the story that you'll often hear that the most popular type of pizza was named after Queen Margherita because she liked it, and she liked the fact that it contained the three traditional colors used in Italian national flags, red for the tomato sauce, white cheese, and green basil, is highly doubtful. The evidence for this culinary legend has been shown to be scanty and untrustworthy. Italian immigrants brought pizza and similar dishes to the United States starting in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and it became gradually a big hit in eastern cities. The first dedicated pizzeria in the United States, which is still there, Lombardi's, was opened in 1905 in Lower Manhattan, just north of what is now Little Italy, and it's in the chic and trendy Nolita neighborhood. Lady Buzzkill used to shop there when we were younger. American GIs sent to Italy during World War II took part, unknowingly, in the first stage of the pizza effect in Italy itself. Many of these soldiers, especially from the eastern part of the U.S., knew about pizza, or if they're from San Francisco, they'd grown up with it, and thought of it as a very popular Italian dish all across Italy. Then they'd also grown up with the fact that American pizzerias had modified it to include, you know, many different meat and vegetable toppings, pepperoni, on and on and on. When they arrived in Italy, they were surprised to discover that pizza had not strayed very far from its regional origins in the Italian South, and that it it remained, you know, a very simple dish without all those flagrant American topping innovations. Again, this is the first part of the pizza effect, breaking down the assumptions of what was Italian to these American GIs. Pizza was different in Italy and wasn't, in fact, the staple and popular food that had become in the U.S., especially in the U.S. Italian-American communities. After World War II, and, you know, with the increasing ease of international tourism, many Americans visited Italy and many Italians visited the United States. And pizza was recognized as the uber dish that it was in America, and Italians coming back home with this knowledge helped spur a pizza revival in the old country, and which has not only lasted until this day, but spread across Europe. Witness the highly popular Pizza Express restaurants founded in London in 1965, but now you can see them, go to them anywhere, almost anywhere in Europe, Middle East, and even Asia. This brief history of pizza that I just gave you was poached shamelessly from Professor Carol Hotalski's excellent Pizza, A Global History, and it's on the Buzzkill bookshelf. This brief history, again, that I've given you is loaded with historical wells and buts and plenty of complication. That's because the history of Italy, like the history of India, even in the modern period, is highly complex. And the ways in which the pizza effect works is highly nuanced. In the first place, it's only relatively recently that we've come to think of Italy and India as unitary countries. The Italian peninsula was unified, as you know, under the Roman Empire in ancient times. But during the Middle Ages, it broke apart. Different regions came under control of increasingly powerful city-states, Rome, Milan, Naples, and others, or they were conquered by foreign monarchs. It was really broken up and lasted for centuries. And there were lots of wars over control over those regions, over those cities, especially the port cities. And one of the effects of this was that regional pride, civic pride, grew very strong. People thought of themselves as Roman or Neapolitan or Florentine rather than Italian, although most of them spoke dialects of the same root language, which was obviously Italian. India developed the same way, except that the differences between the regions were much more pronounced and included different religions and languages. Different foreign invaders conquered large geographic areas of South Asia. But the differences between the regions were stark enough that they often had to rely on local rulers to control subregions. This was especially the case under the Mughal Empire, which was the 16th to the 19th centuries, and during the creeping control of the British from the 18th century until 1947. Now, even then, that is, Indian independence starting in 1947, creating one country was so difficult that it was eventually partitioned into India and Pakistan. Is it any wonder that philosophies and spiritual practices, yoga philosophies, yoga spiritual practices that were developed in the state of Bengal in the far east of the Indian subcontinent might not have taken over all of South Asia? And is it any wonder that a certain regional dish like pizza might not have captured the culinary imaginations of the whole of the Italian peninsula? Look at a map. We're talking about very large areas. But for the most part, the terms Italian and Indian have captured the understanding of people in the West, other people in the West, who may not have had the patience to learn the subtleties of South Asian history and geography, European history and geography, Italian history and geography. Still, by the 1960s, we started to see a pizza renaissance in Italy, a yoga renaissance across India, a Cornish pasty renaissance in the southwest of England, a Clancy Brothers or traditional Irish music renaissance in Ireland, and on and on and on. Some of these specific cultural elements had been reinvented or revived or made more popular in far-off places and then brought back home, and I'm putting home in quotation marks. That's the pizza effect. Right now, however, we need to take a break for station identification for the Buzzkill Nation. I'll be right back to pontificate more broadly about cultural feedback and authenticity. Back in a minute.
This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln is indisposed at the moment, but he asked me to remind you that Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back. This talk of cultural feedback and authenticity brings me to perhaps the ultimate in buzzkilling, dealing with the belief in, or certainly the overuse of, the concepts of authentic, traditional, and pure as they relate to national identities or ethnic cultures or modern national histories. As we've said many times on this show, and as the anguished cries of frustration from Buzzkill Institute researchers reminds me almost every day, all these cultural concepts are very flexible and usually not very long-standing. If there's any truth to the phrase, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, it was the tendency, and perhaps the tendency is still going, but the tendency, as I found it, was particularly strong in the 20th century, the tendency to apply degrees of purity to cultural things and to use that as a status marker. I know more about this than you do. That isn't genuine Irish music, I often used to hear. And I chuckle at this, chuckle to myself anyway, because that's the way I am. But I rarely lowered the boom on these people and asked the person, past whoever was saying it, what constituted, quote, real Irish music? Did you two count? What about the Dave Glover show band? Podcast world will know this is probably the only time the Dave Glover show band is going to be mentioned in the podcast universe. Or was rock music or swing music being produced by Irish musicians not as culturally pure, not as Irish as those who were playing a Balron? Obviously, there are cultural and regional origins of many things, most things. But precious few of them remain hermetically sealed, protected from the march of time and influences from the outside. What's often so surprising to people is that there were lots of sharing back and forth between cultures from at least the mid-19th century onwards, as we've shown in this show, especially when transoceanic travel became more affordable in the age of massive steamships. In fact, it was sometimes easier to travel from Calcutta to London, nearly 5,000 miles by ocean, than to travel from Calcutta to Delhi, 1,300 miles over land. So you were often more likely to find Bengali cuisine, or derivations of Bengali cuisine, in London than you were to find it in Delhi. And Bengali strains or interpretations of Hinduism and Hindu practice might more likely be found in London or Chicago in 1900 than in Mumbai in India. And the pizza effect of all of this is that certain elements in a culture, especially cuisine and artistic things, become popular in their own area or region first, and travel across the seas, become popular in other regions, all the while they've been forgotten or developed in different ways in their home countries, and then are reintroduced there decades later. And in the hearts, minds, and palates of the Buzzkill Institute, the variations are all legitimate and worthy. We should think twice before judging whether specific cultural things are historically authentic or traditional. They may have originated closer to home than you think. When you're thinking about whether something is authentic enough for your palate or your ears or your spiritual sensibilities, remember what St. Stephen of Stills, our patron saint, taught us. Love the one you're with. Talk to you next week.